Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A Listener Production.
Hey, I'm pro surfer and mental health advocate Kubi Chapman, and this is Good Humans. On this episode, I'm hanging out with surfing legend Tom Carroll. Tom is a two-time world champion and an icon on Sydney's northern beaches where I grew up. In this first part of our two-part conversation, Tom paints a picture of just how different the northern beaches of Sydney was back in the day during the birth of professional surfing, why he accidentally became a political icon, and how a competition gone wrong at Pipeline in 1988 cost him his third world title and taught him some hard life lessons that he still carries today. Tommy Carroll, thanks for jumping on Good Humans podcast with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Cooper. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so stoked and I'm really excited for this chat because you've got a story unlike any other, and some of the things that you've done in your life, in your career, will probably never be done again. And some of the things that you've managed to put together, which we're going to talk about in this podcast, are amazing. So let's jump right back to the beginning. Early life, Tom Carroll. I've read your book and there's so many great stories in there, but what sort of family life did you have as a young kid, and what sort of was your introduction into surfing?
I grew up in it. I was born into this house just across from Bungan Beach, where Carlo Parade meets the Barangaroo Road, the one that comes, you know, that comes from the castle around that way.
Yep, yep.
It was on the western side of the main road, which was Barangaroo Road. That back then, there was just two lanes, just one either way. So it wasn't like three lanes, you know, six lane, you know, just varying.
Not people to ride now.
Yeah, the whole Barangaroo strip to Newport's like three lanes. Later it became my racetrack. But, but before that, I was living, with my family there. My mum passed away when I was seven, and she actually gave me a surfboard just the couple of months before she passed at Christmas when I turned seven. And the whole time we were living there, I remember during summer there was always someone walking up there's a pathway, a right-of-way access to a cul-de-sac just down our backyard. We had a long backyard, big terrace backyard. Our father used to make us rake up all the mowing cuttings, you know. It was a big Saturday when he decided to mow the lawn, and we were locked in to the job, Nick and I. But our sister didn't have to do it. But anyway, Nick and I had to get in the job. But that was from that cul-de-sac, and that right of way was a pathway over up to the main road, and that would lead over the road and down another pathway, which would go all the way down to the beach. It was a big walk. But I used to watch this person carrying this longboard with a towel between the longboard and their head, and they just walk up. I'm going, what's that person doing, you know? I remember that sort of image. When I got that surfboard from mum, it was a foam surfboard, a Coolite surfboard, so it was super buoyant. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know you needed wax. I remember the first surf. It was, we just went out. It was flat, almost flat, super hot day. There was this little wave every now and then hitting and I couldn't stay on the board because it was super slippery. I had a paint job over it, and had a racing stripe down one side. It was green with a yellow racing stripe, and I couldn't paddle. And I'd see a wave coming on, I'd just throw the thing because I didn't know what to do. But that was my introduction to the ocean on a surfboard. But I would see these surfers down the beach, and my eyes would start to kind of drift towards what they were doing. They were riding the waves. It looked kind of surreal. From there, It was a Thursday afternoon. I'll never forget it, that I actually finally stood up on the surf. We did figure out the wax thing because <you know? laughs> we figured it out. We ended up getting this Ampol wax at the Ampol service station. It was basically beeswax. And we had to kind of like, because you couldn't rub it on. It wouldn't stay. You had to melt it on. And that's tricky on a styrofoam block, melting things on. But we got it and that actually worked, stay on the board. And I finally, and just a little while down the track, I'll never forget, it was a Thursday afternoon, I actually stood up for the first time into the shore break in front of the surf club at Newport. And I kind of came out of the shore break, got pounded. And my dad was right there and, he goes, oh, I go, Dad, I just stood up for about a minute. And he goes, maybe a second. And I was like a killer. I was like, oh, Dad. I'm like, really? It felt like a minute, you know? And so I was bit. Just on that one moment, I was bit with that thing.
You're hooked.
I was hooked. Yeah, mate. I was so hooked. So 7 years old, that was the journey. Started that summer. In 1968,
wow.
and I started the journey, and it was our mum passed away a couple of months later, and then my dad thought, oh, let's get a sort of house up closer to the beach, so he found a block of land in Newport, and we built a house, and I couldn't believe it. I'm like, whoa, how's where we're living? It was the best. It really started afresh after mum passed away. And so that was a walking distance, basically a bike ride. I didn't have a bike yet, but I had to earn the money to, get a bike. But my first fiberglass surfboard was $25. And I had to ask my father to borrow the money off my father and then actually get the courage up to do that. And that was another one of those postcards from the edge where you can never forget it. It was plucking up the courage to ask my dad if I could borrow or maybe have. I didn't know what borrow was, He actually said, oh, I'll tell you what, Tom. I said, I'll do it, but you're going to have to pay me back. You're going to have to get a job and pay me back. I'm like, by then I was like 10. So I had to go and get a job. And I got a job down at local paper shop, the newsagent.
Yeah.
And I was there at 4:30 in the morning on Saturday and Sunday morning to help roll the papers, the big, big newspapers back then on a Sunday, like big, two big newspapers on a Sunday and one big one on the Saturday. It had to be rolled in this rolling machine. And then the newsagent owner, David Pitt, had one of those mini moke cars, it's got like a soft top.
Oh, yeah.
They're like little moke.
Yeah.
He used to pile all the papers in that thing. We'd load it all up and he used to drive the whole area around Newport and part of Avalon, the Bulgola Plateau.
Yeah.
And just throw them from his front seat and throw them into people's front yard as he went. So that was like from 4:30 to 7 a.m. every morning, getting $1.50 each morning. So I'd pay it back that way.
That's pretty cool. I love the idea that your dad drew that work ethic into you, and your ability to remember back that far is so beautiful, and it's so awesome, the imagery, and you can see your face light up when you remember those initial surf days, because it brought so much joy, obviously, to you, your surf career. And a very successful surf career it was. Can you remember much about your junior competing days and when you started to realize, surfing's a career path for me, or was it always just about that love of the ocean?
Really, it's just I didn't know what I was doing competing at first. I was introduced to competition surfing in what was the Peninsula Board Riders Club at Palm Beach. I used to get together with my buddy, Michael Twemlow. Back then we were probably 12, and we'd hitch on a Saturday morning, grab our boards, either hitch or get in a bus, and we'd go and, hitch up at our buddy's place at Palm Beach at Bod Nowen and David Ravenscroft's house, and they were in the board riders club there called, you know, Peninsula Board Riders. And I started surfing in that club and just surfing Palm Beach. And, you know, like back then, 12-year-old, I just say goodbye to my grandmother who was looking after us at that time. That was my mum's mum and my dad, and say, we'll see you on Sunday night. Yeah, I'll see you on Sunday night. There was no like, you're like 12, 13, just on a bus, gone for the weekend, didn't know where we were going. It was just the way it was back then. Mm. So today it's like, oh, so you better call me. You know, in the next 5 minutes, you better call me. Just tell me where you are. You know, it's like helicopter stuff right now. But back then it was, you know, we were out there competing in the club, in this club. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just going there and I won the cadet overall the year that year. And I, in the club, and the club president, Owen Ravenscroft, who is a brilliant surfer, I still love watching him surf, and beautiful style. And he once, after a club event, he said, look, would you like to surf in the Northern Beaches? And I said, what's that? Well, as a club, we can enter you into the Northern Beaches and we can get your entry in now. They're asking for entries. And so I said, well, what's it mean? He goes, well, you know, we go and surf against all the surfers from
Narrabeen.
That's where we went to Narrabeen to surf it. And I was 12, and all the surfers from Manly all the way to Palm Beach, we all surfing against each other, and the winners go on to surf into the state, into the team to go and surf in the state championships. New South Wales said, so what happens if you go to the state championships if you win? And he goes, what if you win the state? He goes, oh, you go to the national championships. And I'm going, whoa, wow. So what if you win the national championships? He goes, well, you go to the world championships. I go, wow. So he kind of, when he said that, I'll never forget that too. It's really clear that there was this like a stepping stone thing that this is how, and then the kind of like this little spark of ambition sort of lit up. I wouldn't say that I was saying to myself at 12, I'm going to be world champion. But there was some sort of like kind of dream that was made up at that point, that there was a way of kind of broadening out with this activity of competing and surfing. But I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't know what I was doing when I was competing. I just was just going out to surf, and I'd come in and they'd read out the results. Oh, Tom, you got through. Oh, okay. Oh, when's the next date? Da, da, da. It was a bit like that. There was no, very raw.
Yeah, I love that. Different to now.
Totally different to now. And we'd go, no one's coaching anyone. There was no, and then we get to the Northern Beaches. I'll never forget going to Narrabeen for the Northern Beaches event. And that first one, I was down at the alley.
Cole Smith and stuff.
Yeah, Cole Smith. He's my first view of seeing, you know, Owen pointed him out. I'll never forget that moment. He goes, hey, Tom, you got to watch this guy surf. It's Cole Smith. You watch him surf. You watch his whole board come out. And I'm like watching him backlit, and the alley rights are going, and he's just going doing vertical re-entries after vertical re-entry at the alley. Just see his round tail and, you know, everything. I was like, wow. Never seen anything like it.
Yeah, there's so many good talents on the Northern Beaches. And from such an early age, obviously, there's been a lot of world champs out of the Northern Beaches, Barton Lynch, yourself, and then other guys like Simon Anderson and stuff. So there was obviously a really good group of you guys coming through. And I'm going to fast forward a little bit now because there's so much I want to talk to you about.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because there's been so much amazing things that have happened in your life. One moment that I really have a lot of respect for is after your second world title, South Africa.
Right,
That's something that I read, and something that me, and through my business with the Good Human Factor, I really love to see people who stand up for things and stand up for what they value. Can you talk me through that situation with, I think it was 1985,
South Africa,
after your second world title?
It was 1985.
Yeah.
And it was May 1985, was at Bells. I'd already sort of been competing in South Africa for 4 years, and each year I felt, you know, I felt more uncomfortable going there. And it, on the world stage at that point, particularly with the United Nations, you know, black banning athletes and so on, and organisations for going there and supporting it, the apartheid, and actually regime, and seeing firsthand what was going on, I felt super uncomfortable. But when it came to me being two times world champion, feeling a certain amount of like, this is where I can be heard.
Bit of responsibility. And you're only 24 at the time. Yeah,
I was only 24. Wow. And that was like, okay, so I can, I can't live with being a supporter of this. I couldn't like go, okay, does this mean I'm a supporter? If I go and compete, does this for the whole world to see and watch, this is me going there as a world champion surfer, is seen as being someone who supports apartheid. I can't do that.
Yeah, if you're not against it, you're for it. Like.
Yeah. So that's how it was. And it was a very strong issue at the time. And there was a lot of demonstrations around it, around the planet. There was a lot of movement towards evolving beyond it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And so I thought it was the perfect time. I just won my second world title. I had quite a lot of media attention just for that. So I used it at that time. I actually delivered it during an interview with a newspaper. It was just, I didn't know how to communicate. Like, as 24 years old, pretty raw now today, I wasn't like a media machine in myself. Today, people are media machines within themselves. It's amazing. So, and there's a lot of knowledge, a lot of awareness and knowledge around how to actually deliver communication. So then it was very raw. I didn't know how to communicate. I was just went, oh, look, this is what I want to do. I want to boycott the event in South Africa, and just went, blew up. And I was like, it just turned into a lot bigger deal. And I must admit I was naive in that sense. All I knew that I just was going to do it anyway. But I just was naive into knowing what the kind of response was going to come back to me.
Yeah, you just thought you were not going to some events.
I said, look,
it was a personal thing, it seems.
It was
like
a very personal humanitarian stand, simple. I wasn't trying to come at anyone other than the fact that I just can't agree with this. As a world champion surfer, I can't be seen to support it.
Yeah.
And that was it. And I gave my point of view and over and across in an interview, and then all of a sudden I'm doing, like press conferences.
The Prime Minister and stuff, weren't you?
Press conferences, and, I knew that I was possibly going to lose my sponsor, who was actually based in South Africa in California, but I thought maybe if the operation out of California and plus my relationship with Sean Thompson might be compromised because of this, but I just needed to do it. But I didn't talk to him first. I didn't talk to all these other people first. I just went, whoa. Maybe I could have done it in another way, but it was just going to probably done a bit better. I would have done it. If I was to do it again, I would have definitely communicated in different layers. But I didn't know that then. I just was very raw and the next minute I'm with Bob Hawke, and we were talking about, he was supporting me and actually helping me as a young Australian who'd made a significant stand, which he fully backed.
That's so beautiful.
And, it was really cool. And from there on in, it's just been an incredible journey with that. I ended up meeting Nelson Mandela and talking with him, and it was just a beautiful meeting that. And then when Nelson Mandela said, look, Tom, thank you. When he makes me cry a bit, because he brings up a lot of emotion. Because that one moment was like, it was such a powerful coming from him, who'd suffered so much, like 28 years in solitary confinement.
Wow.
And the aura that comes off someone who's been through that, who has got no, it's just completely, you know, we walk around with little, even if we're quite a fearless person, we still bubble with fear. Like there was just none of that. Someone who's absolutely fearless. I'm not saying someone who's doing something stupid fearless. This is solid fearlessness. This is a fearlessness we don't, I'd never really come across, to be honest. And I could sense it with him, and his aura is very powerful. So you just get this beautiful thank you. I really needed all the support I could get at that time. And I know that when I was making the decision to do it, I just needed to know. It was helpful to talk to a few people. They said, look, even if you change one person's mind, one person just to question why you'd want to be that kind of person who would look at another person just because of the colour of their skin as someone to be fearful of, someone who's different, someone to actually look down upon for some reason and change that. That was the key. That was it. If I could get one person to just question that, I've done my job.
One of the other moments in your career that stands out to me that I wanted to chat to you about, 1988 pipeline interference.
Yeah.
So that one could have been your third world title. Talk me through that day, the emotions going through your mind, more so after the call, and what how you dealt with it and how you think you might have dealt with it differently now.
Okay, well, I'll go back to the lead up into the day. It's like I actually had a really good board, like a really good board for pipe. Beautiful 7.6 Pat Rawson that we'd actually done a redo on a bunch of boards that weren't quite right, and there's been a big waiting period for this day, and so there was quite a lot of tension coming into that last event with four of us. I think there was four of us able to win the world title that day, and so it was a real – and pipeline was – it was solid, a beautiful, solid. It was really beautiful. The day it got better, but perfect in the morning. When I look back on it, the way I was dealing with the tension, the nervous tension was not so good. I was so like wound up on that day. I was way too wound up. When I think about it, for that particular rule, particularly because
they changed it that night, didn't they?
They changed it that night. So, and I'd already had interference on that ruling earlier on the year, and that was when I was way down the beach, and someone else got—I can't remember who got that on me. It was in New Jersey of all places.
No, just like,
how did that happen? I come in, oh, you got an interference. I go, what? What? The guy was like, yeah, this is, he had priority and
same, you know, swell line.
Same like swell line. There's deemed the same swell line. You move for the wave. I've gone like on the other side. I'm like on another bank. So it was tricky. It was good for the judges because it could keep really black and white, but it wouldn't make sense today. We just go, what the hell are you thinking? So pipeline was, you know, it was my second heat. I'd beaten Noah Budrow in the first heat. Paddling out man on man at pipe was man on man.
First event man on man, wasn't
first
it?
First event man on man at pipe. It was not Pipeline Masters, it was Billabong Pro. So it was the last event of the tour and it was all coming down. Billabong Pro was actually a mobile event, could be held at Waimea Bay, could be held at Haleiwa, Sunset Beach or Pipeline. So it had four different venues you could compete in. So you had to be ready for all these different waves. It was such a cool event.
That's an epic.
And it was man on man. It was like crazy. I was paddling out on the first man on man heat against Noah Bud Rowe at Pipeline. And I'll never forget that paddle out because it was flawless, no wind, and big TPA frames coming through second reef. Like I'm like, oh, my God, this is like the perfect day. And I'm just way over frothed. So I'm sort of trying to breathe and calm myself, and I'm paddling out and I'm taking the wave because there's no one else. Noah takes a little insider. I go, what's he thinking? And then I paddle out and and there's no one in the lineup, no one to gauge anything off. This very odd feeling at pipe when it's perfect. I just never had that experience. Rare. So I take the wave from the, you know, the first crazy looking wave, and I took it at the, I wanted to go deeper, and I kind of took it on the, just on the top of the peak kind of thing. And I was cursing myself for taking the drop, I'll never forget, because I wasn't deep enough. I'm going, you got to get deeper, man. It's like, but anyway, that was the kind of nervousness that I was carrying. I was just not loose enough to go deep. And I felt that in that first heat. Coming up in the second heat, I beat Noah. I went on to the second heat against Todd Holland. And Todd Holland, in fact, was just, he'd grown up like this full hick beard. He was like, he was chewing tobacco and stuff. He was like complete classic Florida boy, you know, good old boy. And I'd known him for quite a year, few years, and he just made a shift. And I'll never forget turning up to Hawaii in that first day, driving from the airport. I went straight to Pipe to have a look at it. This is a little side story. And I walked up the right of way where the Volcom House is now to look at Pipeline, and it's ugly. I mean, it's screwed up, ugly pipe, and it's onshore, and there's kind of like crazy ones from Third Reef coming through and washing through. There's one guy out there and he's just taken off on anything. It's Todd Holland. I'm going, what is he thinking? So anyway, I got him in my heat.
that guy.
He was on a mission, and I was so nerved out that I was looking for every wave, every opportunity, because I was two heats away from winning a world title. And I'd spent 3 years trying to get myself back to this position, and it was quite a haul to get to that point. But my system was too overloaded with that nervousness, and I was just looking at every opportunity that Pipe would offer and looking at every wave. He had priority, and he saw me just spin around and move and have a look at this wave when I saw him not go for it because he was further out, and I thought I'd stay underneath his priority and then maybe, you know, sneak into one. It was a pretty solid one. It was
scared to sneak into them.
I had 10-foot wave just right on first reef, and I looked down it, and then I felt him go past me, and it was just going to be this ugly closeout. He actually went down it, went backdoor, got closed out on, got smashed. Then they get called the interference out. So I go, oh, my God. And I knew it straight away when I saw him go past because I knew the rule. But I'd actually, he was still a little way from me. It wasn't like he was right on me. So there was no actual interference. It was just technicality. And so anyway, I had to kind of, you know, come in and I sort of took a few more waves, really getting more upset, you know, getting more upset with myself, getting more kind of hard on myself. And, you know, it was just a head in my hands sort of moment. And I walked to the beach just so, like, shattered. But they said, oh, look, you know, they're still doing a count on the judges because I ended up winning on one judge even with that. And so I was easily in the lead in the heat, but I was kept on looking for more opportunity. I was just too antsy.
It's a really good lesson in that.
Really good lesson. I mean, I learnt my lesson big time, but there was also, yeah, but anyway, I ended up in the back street of Keiki Heart, you know, the Keiki Kainui Road, and where my rental car was there, and I was just in there. I was just smashing the steering wheel with my fists, you know, like I just sort of let loose on the steering wheel and just fucking did my knuckles in a bit. But I was like so pissed off at myself mostly, and really upset. And I kind of had a downward spiral from there. It wasn't a nice experience at all. It was like Pipeline delivered me, you know, when I look at it now, delivered me my highest points and my lowest points. Pipeline delivered to me, and that experience of being at the highest point and lowest point of myself is so significant. So I've got a deep relationship with Pipeline. It goes a lot deeper than what I even thought of. And at that time, I didn't know how much it really affected me until many, many years later. I sort of came off that experience and I put so much into that year, and then all of a sudden they overturned the rule because it didn't make any sense. They said, oh, we're just going to change the rule for next year. I just couldn't trust putting all my effort into a whole year and have that happen again. I just couldn't. Some deeper thing in me just said, well, I'm not ever going to put my trust into this, like the full campaign again. I'm backing completely off. I tried to do the tour the next year and I couldn't get through a heat. I was like, my head wasn't in it, and I stepped off the tour about 6 months in and took a full break from the tour. It was completely devastating. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to come back. I want to win events that I absolutely love, and that's the Poplar Masters and Margaret River. Both of those events I really loved, and ended up winning them again and doing really well with them. So, but it wasn't until like 14 years down the track, and my brother's, it was a surfer's journal, did a bunch of biographies on surfers, like documentaries on surfers of their time, and they did one on me, and they, in that, there was an interview with my brother, and they said, oh, so what happened? It was all about that moment. He goes, I think at that point he lost trust with pro surfing. Mm-hmm. And I've gone, holy shit, he's right. And I never saw that, but I'd actually lost trust in it. And so I didn't really give everything to it from that point on, like I'd had done before. But so I suffered in all these different ways and areas. And it just takes one comment from someone really close to you, can really get a good view of you, can actually sort of open those doors to what was really going on. And back then, I didn't have the communication skills to get that.
Good Humans was presented by me, Cooper Chapman, producer, Alex Mitchell, audio production by Darcy Thompson.
Listener. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.